Allow me to welcome you to State Affairs. I'm calling the meeting to order at 4 minutes after 9, Thursday, February 25th, 2010. At this time, please turn off your electronic devices. Thank you. On the agenda today, we have a Senate Bill 266, Violent Crimes Emergency Compensation, Senate Bill 278, Leave for Military Spouses. Let the record reflect that we have to my right Senator French and Senator Meyer, and I'm Senator Menard, and I'd like to introduce my committee aide, Sarah Munson, and also we have with us Molly George and Luke Woodruff as the LIO coordinator. Are you both ready to go? Okay, so let's take up Senate Bill 266, Violent Crimes Emergency Compensation. And Senator Thomas Staff Greer Hopkins is here. Would you state your name for the record and your affiliation, please?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Greer Hopkins. I'm staff to Senator Joe Thomas. Thank you for hearing our bill, okay. Having us here today.
And then with you today, if you...
With me today is Kate Hudson, who's the administrator for the Victims of Violent Crimes Compensation Board.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 266 proposes to increase the limit the victims of violent crimes can receive an emergency compensation from $1,500 to $3,500. This limit has not been increased since 1975 and is used primarily for relocation and counseling for families and victims who safety and well-being are at risk. In addition to relocation and counseling, emergency compensation can only be awarded for verifiable lost wages and security measures. The main reason for this increase is that the cost for emergency expenses have increased substantially over the years, and the $1,500 that they've had since 1975 simply cannot cover first and last month's rent and deposit when a relocation is necessary for family or dependents. Emergency awards are necessary because the board only meets about 5 times every year, and it can be several weeks or months before a claim is considered. Sometimes we need to get a victim out of harm's way before that. The Victims Compensation Fund receives approximately 70% of its appropriations from the state in the form of withheld permanent fund dividends from felons. The additional 30% comes from a federal grant that the board must apply for every year. Emergency compensation is deducted from the final amount given to the victim, and any excess award must be repaid to the fund. The bill does not increase the overall cap of $40,000 that an individual can receive from the board, and there is a zero fiscal impact to the state. I urge you to join me in assisting Alaska's victims in their greatest time of need and support Senate Bill 266. I believe there's Mr. Godfrey, who's the chair of the board, is available online to make some comments also. I believe he's online.
And I'm going to have the record reflect that Senator Kukesh has joined us. Are there any questions from any committee members? Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning. Excellent bill, great idea. Wish I'd thought of it myself. Tell me, can the is there a sufficient pot of money available to pay out under these emergency claims? Should we increase the level? That is, do we risk exhausting the emergency pot of money if we award more per victim?
The amount of $40,000 was recently increased, I believe, earlier in the decade, they have not yet run out of money when the appropriations from the legislature, but there is an ever-increasing amount of claims every year necessary to help our victims. So as they haven't run out yet, I'm sure they wouldn't have any problem with an increased amount for that pot.
And just to follow up, I take it this bill is supported by the folks that make the awards, the Violent Crime Compensation Board?
Senator French, through the chair, yes, sir. The bills, actually, they were the impetus for the idea behind the bill.
Great. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Okay. Are there any other questions? And I do want to say you came to the office and you did an excellent job of explaining it, and it looks like we're pretty comfortable with what you're trying to go forward with. So at this time, then, is there any one off net that wants to testify? Okay. All right, we have Jared Godfrey online to testify. Jared, are you there for Senate Bill 266? Please identify yourself and affiliation for our record. Thank you.
Yes, I am, Madam Chair. This is Jared Godfrey, Chair of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board.
Go ahead and give your testimony, please.
I apologize for not hearing. I just patched in 2 minutes ago. I didn't hear the entire setup, but I will just say that the board was the initiators of this. We requested it basically in light of the fact that when the board was created, emergency awards were put in place for people in dire need of awards in between our board meetings. And that was, at $500 back then, and then it was adjusted upwards in 1975. The board was created in 72, so in 75 it was adjusted upwards to $1,500, and it has stood ever since. And adjusted for inflation, we've been told that would actually be over $6,000, which the board has no interest in raising emergency award to that level. There's no need for it. However, in particular, what we deal with, the board will only hear three criteria for an emergency award. One is lost wages. If somebody submits a claim and it's just after we finished a board meeting, they could literally be waiting 10, 11 weeks before our next board meeting, and they have actual losses from lost wages. So we'll hear that in the interim. And that can obviously be, a couple $1,000 depending on, what their income was at that time. And, of course, that's verified. Another would be counseling. We certainly don't expect someone, if the only thing keeping them from a counselor and they need a counselor is the ability to afford a counselor, to wait 10 or 11 weeks when they're dealing with a traumatic event or loss, at that time. And the other would be relocation. That specifically happens in instances of domestic violence. In particular, it would be an instance where typically a female would be abused, beaten, or such, or she may discover her child is being beaten by a husband or a boyfriend or a stepfather, or worse, even sexually assaulted, and she cooperates with law enforcement and is in fear for her life at that time when this gentleman or this person makes bail. He's threatened her, when I get out, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to find you, and we certainly don't want her to wait 10, 11 weeks to our next board meeting to relocate her and get her out of that place where he can find her. And that in particular is the problem with $1,500. $1,500 hardly can get you out of one community into another. First and last month's rent, security deposit, a U-Haul, or a plane ticket, to relocate you away from that abuser. And so we've been able to get around it often because there may be a child or two children involved. And so in the aggregate, you got up to $1,500 per victim. So we'd have $4,500 to relocate the three of them. But it has been happening on occasion where it's just a woman who's cooperating with law enforcement, and she may not have a minor child with her that we're seeking to relocate. And so that $1,500 may not do it. And if we can't award more than that between that and the board meeting, she's stuck if she can't front it until the board meeting. And that's really where this concern came about, is the need to get that raised up, since it hasn't since 1975. And it's important to clarify that this is not an issue of giving them more money. I heard somebody phrase it, it's kind of like an advance on a paycheck. When all is done and said at our board meeting, we're going to say that they had real and actual losses to the tune of $11,500. It's just giving them more of what they're going to get up front. I see the prudence absolutely in the legislature back when they put a cap on the emergency award, allocation, the amount that can be utilized for an emergency award, and I believe that's prudent today. There needs to be, the function of the board is not to be adjudicating, four or five claims in between board meetings. That's not the purpose, and that's why the board will only hear those three categories of emergency awards that I listed earlier. So that's basically, what I have to say. If anyone has any questions, I'd be glad to take them.
We do appreciate your testimony, Mr. Godfrey, and I will turn it now over to the board members should they have any comments or questions. Seeing none, again, thank you for giving up your time to testify to us. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Kukesh.
I noticed on the table that you gave us, which talks about the people who received the awards, that seven were out of state. How do you define that?
When you say, I can hear you real well.
Okay.
But when you
well, your application for compensation was received from all regions of the state. It says you received total Alaska 703 last year. And then out of state seven. What does that mean? What does the out of state seven mean?
I will defer this to our administrator because I'm not looking at that. But prior to that, I will just clarify that anybody that comes to Alaska that is a victim of a violent crime here, whether they're a resident or not, they are eligible for compensation statutorily. So if someone from California is just visiting on vacation for a week and they are victimized and then they go back to California, they're entitled to compensation. And likewise, if we have an Alaskan citizen in a state, but there wouldn't because all states have their own version of this, but in a country like in Mexico, we've done this, and as well as in Indonesia, and they are victimized being an Alaska citizen or a resident of Alaska, we also are obliged to compensate them. We had that, I think in 2003, there was that Bali nightclub bombing in Indonesia, and we had young lady from Eagle River, Alaska, who died in that terrorist attack there, and we paid to bring her body back and for her funeral. And that's statutory. Without knowing what you're looking at, sir, I will defer that to Kate Hudson, my administrator, but I will say that may be accounting for that. It may be an applicant who was a victim that was not a citizen of Alaska, or it may be an applicant who relocated, because we will relocate victims out of Alaska where they have a support network. Often it would be a domestic violence victim whose mom or dad or both parents live, you know, somewhere else in the state. We don't just give them a plane ticket. It's not like that. We compensate them, you know, after the fact, and we make them show us their plan. You know, why do you want to go here or there? Why will that be better for you? Those would be the two categories that without seeing what you're looking at, that I would imagine it falls under. But please defer that to Administrator Kate Hudson, who I believe is available.
Kate, would you like to add clarification to that? Is that okay, thank Senator Kukesh?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Through the Chair, Senator Kukesh, I believe you're looking at the table in our annual report.
It's from your report, Violent Crimes Compensation Board, yes.
Right. And the seven out-of-state claims that you're referring to, I'm just going to confirm what Mr. Godfrey said. Those are people who reside out-of-state, but for one reason or another were claiming compensation for Alaska, either because they were visitors here and were the victims of crime while they were mm-hmm. here, or from memory, I do believe that a number of those seven were people who were relatives of homicide victims who were traveling from out of state to attend the funeral in Alaska, and that is something, again, that the board will compensate for. So the vast majority of our claimants are Alaska residents, but the statute does allow us to compensate visitors to Alaska also. Just as an Alaska resident, if they were the victim of a violent crime in another state, they would be compensated under that state's program.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. No. Are there any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And I don't see anyone else that has signed up in the audience to speak. However, I will give an opportunity if someone does want to come up and take 3 minutes for a testimony. Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony, and we will have a discussion. Do fellow committee members want to comment or have a discussion at this time? Senator French.
Madam Chair, I think it's a good bill, and if you're ready for a motion, I'd be happy to make one.
Okay. What is the will of the committee on this bill? Do I hear a motion for Senate Bill 266 for the committee with individual recommendations?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move that Senate Bill 266 be moved out of this committee on to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations.
Do I hear any objections? Hearing none, Senate Bill 266 moves out of State Affairs to Finance. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the bill. Thank you very much. 78, leave for military spouses. I believe this bill is from Senator Wilikowski, who we're honored with here to be today. Would you come forward and state your name and affiliation for the record? Yes.
Thank you.
Bring the bill forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Wilikowski. I'm State Senator for Northeast Anchorage, and I appreciate you taking up this bill. Madam Chair, there are a few things as sacred to service members and their loved ones who are serving in combat zones as the leave that they earn and are entitled to from that combat zone. And what this bill does is it allows the spouses of soldiers serving in combat zones to take off up to 10 days of unpaid leave from work while that soldier is on leave from a combat zone. And this bill applies to all active duty and reserve members whose family members live in Alaska. Leave for soldiers is often unpredictable. The last thing a spouse should be worried about is having to get time off from their employer to spend time with their loved one who may have a few days off from the combat zone. And we've heard some horror stories from people who have not been granted that leave, and that's what has stemmed this bill. There are 10 states that have bills that are similar to this. Some are much more expansive. Some allow up to 30 days of leave. We're trying to be understanding of the business community, and we've limited it to 10 days. It's a rather lengthy bill. It's 6 pages, but it really is a simple concept, and that is granting leave for spouses up to 10 days when their spouse is on leave from a combat zone. There are currently, I think, 4 combat zones that are classified right now. The Arabian Peninsula areas, including the Persian Gulf, the Kosovo area, and Afghanistan. So it doesn't have a huge impact, not a huge number of people who would be impacted by this. I will note that there is a letter of opposition in here from the NFIB, and a little bit surprised by the opposition. I know most Alaskans are overwhelmingly supportive of the troops here in Alaska, and I know that when similar bills have come up, we've talked to other states, there's been zero opposition to these bills, and my staffer, also George Ascott, also spoke with people in other states who told us that there really have been no complaints from similar types of legislation in other states. I'll stop right there, Madam Chair. Happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate you taking this up.
Okay, I will yield it to my committeeman, but I did have one. Has there been consideration of the parents of the soldiers as well, as oftentimes they're working, and you could take this on and on, and has that been discussed? And maybe if you could just speak to that, and then I'll turn it over. I have some other questions as well.
Yes, Madam Chair. And actually, other states have provisions like that. Other states have provisions for siblings, for grandparents, for close relationships. Again, we were trying to limit the impact of this. We were trying to be considerate of the business community, start out small, and just leave it to spouses. But I would certainly leave that to the will of the committee to make changes.
From a personal standpoint, as far as being from the private sector, I would think that it wouldn't have to be legislated that they would give the time off. I mean, I think that's reasonable. And I don't know what kind of impact that has on small businesses when all of a sudden, say if you only have 2 or 3 employees and they're having to, and so I'm very sensitive to that. But I will turn it over. Is there questions from? Okay, Senator French.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just so we make a good record, Senator Wilikowski, I think this is a great idea. I really support you in it. Thank you for bringing the bill to us. Just so we know, this will apply to teachers, that is, teachers who work for the state of Alaska, public employees, again, public employees working for the state of Alaska. We already have a provision in federal law for those employees, if I'm right. And so probably the issue, such as it is, boils down to private sector employees, and I think as I was glancing through the bill, it only applies to those private sector employers who have
20 or more full-time, part-time, or temporary employees. Is that right?
Yes, Senator French, through the chair. And that is to address that concern that you have a small business with two or three employees, and you can't lose that would be a huge loss. And that's why we felt it was appropriate to, again, be considered a small business and limit it to 20 employees.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's all I have.
Does the employer have the right to somehow research that, in fact, that employee is married to this soldier? Is there a mechanism in place where they can legally check on that?
Madam Chair,
verify.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly appropriate. I think if someone were to misrepresent that they had a spouse in the armed forces, I do employment law. I that would be grounds for termination, and I don't think there's a judge or an arbitrator in the world who would say that was not. Some states, I believe Indiana has a provision in their bill that allows for documentation in that regard. I would certainly be open to something like that if the committee feels that's important. Again, if someone were to misrepresent that, I think that would not bode well for them in future employment situations.
And I'm sure your office has done their due diligence to study these 10 states and all the variations of and has extracted from them the best of each state's bill to come up with your bill, which you feel you want to bring forward to us today.
We tried, and I believe there's a packet of information, and we didn't put it together, but it was just something that we came across as we were researching this, and it does discuss in detail the what the other states have. This is really a growing trend. The first state that adopted this was New York back in 2007, and since then you've had 9 others, and so there is, I believe there's something that you have in your packet, Madam Chair, that talks a little bit about what each state does and what they require and the little nuance differences that exist.
And then I guess another follow-up question would be, are there other states like Alaska that are currently, it's in the hopper where they're this legislative session, they're looking at it?
Turn that over to my staffer, George.
For the record, my name is George Escott, staff to Senator Wilikowski. I am not aware of any states at this moment. I did quite a bit of research on it, and I don't know of any other. There is a federal bill in under Senator Ron Wyden that would expand it federally to this, basically do the same thing. So that may have had some impact, but I don't know. That bill has not passed, and I don't know what the status of it is.
Okay. So, Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think your question is good about being able to verify if indeed the spouse or if you extend it to family members truly was in a combat zone. You wish you wouldn't have to do that, but unfortunately some people will try to take advantage of a good program. But I guess one thing that concerns me a little bit is that a person can just leave their job, whether it be a school teacher or they be a person working at a retail store that has more than 10 employees without notice. They can just take off. And if that happened at, Fred Meyer, for example, or any large retail store right before Christmas, that could be devastating. And certainly to a small rural school, if a teacher left for 10 days without notice, that could be devastating and quite costly to the school districts. How do other states deal with this?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, we have the drafter online on regarding the notice issue. We had the same concerns that you do about the notice, and it's. And I'll let the drafter address why he felt we shouldn't define it a little more narrowly, but we're happy to try to do that if that's what the will of the committee is. The one concern is policy. It's a policy call, and we as a state are saying that as a policy we want to support the troops as best we can and allow the spouses to have this time off, and it may cause a little bit of hardship for some of the employers out there, but we're saying these people are putting their lives on the line, and we want to support them however we can. On the notice requirement, a lot of times the leave is very unpredictable. The notification that the combat service man or woman gets is very unpredictable, and so it can be challenging for them to. I mean, ideally, we'd know that, okay, you're going to get time off in a month, and the spouse could say, I need time off in a month, and I guess in an ideal world that would happen. But a lot of times, flights are delayed, and orders for R&R are coming at the last minute. So it was challenging to try to come up with some sort of policy that addressed that. But I would turn to the drafter. I believe he's online.
Yes, his name is Dan Wayne.
Yeah.
Okay, so Mr. Wing, is that all right with the committee members? Okay, then we'll go ahead and turn to Mr. Wing.
He's not on.
Oh, he's not on. Okay. I do have, we can go ahead then with maybe Jeffrey Mitten.
I actually have additional questions unless you want to take public testimony.
No, go ahead with your additional questions.
I thank you, Madam Chair. And again, there's nothing more important in my mind than our military folks who are out there risking their lives on our behalf. I'm just wondering if there isn't a way to do the same thing and maybe soften the blow a little bit, both to the public employees and the private employees. I noticed, and this might be a question for later, that there isn't a fiscal note. But I would think if we had a state employee gone for 10 days that we'd have to, fill in behind him temporarily anyway. So that would be a question I would have later on for the administration.
I can add to that,
sure.
Too, in a teaching situation, you're paying for a substitute to come in, and that's an additional cost out of.
Wait, and I would just add, Madam Chair, and Senator Meyer, this is unpaid leave, so for a state employee, they don't get paid for the time that they're off. So it actually probably has a positive impact to the state because you have someone who's not getting paid for 10 days. For a substitute teacher, they don't typically get paid anywhere near what a regular teacher does. So it would again have a positive fiscal impact.
Madam Chair,
yes. Follow up, Senator Meyer.
If we have state employees that can be gone for 10 days and not have an impact, then we probably have too many employees. I mean, I'm assuming they're doing full-time jobs, and if they're not there, somebody else has to do it. So you'd have to bring in a temporary employee to, and as, I would actually like to hear from Superintendent Como on this because I think getting substitute teachers at a last minute, and they do pay, I think, $125 a day, which is substantially less than a full teacher. But still, that has an impact, too, on the quality of education. So I think the bill is great, and I love it. I think it's got some far-reaching impacts here that maybe we haven't explored, and there may be ways to, for me anyway, to temper the blow.
And Madam Chair,
I am
certainly open to suggestions or ideas on how we can temper that blow.
We do have the bill drafter online now, if that's okay, Senator Kukesh. Okay. Could you state your name, please, for the record and affiliation?
Hi, my name's Dan Wayne. I'm a lawyer with Legislative Legal Affairs.
Okay, you haven't been privy probably to the information that we've been discussing on Senate Bill 278, correct?
Correct.
So we had some questions. We were hoping that you, well, first of all, are you in support of this bill?
I'm just a drafter. I don't support or not support bills.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to just speak to it in a general term? I think Senator Wilikowski had some direct questions for you.
If I could, Madam Chair, I think the question that Senator Meyer had was on the timeliness of the request for leave, and my staff had a conversation with you about just how do you define a reasonable time for a person giving a this notice? And you had some concerns just from a drafting perspective over that is what's been relayed to me. So perhaps you could discuss those a bit.
It's not defined, so it would be subject to interpretation by the employer, and if there was a dispute, by whoever was resolving the dispute.
So that's the short answer?
Yes, that's the answer.
Okay. Is there any other? Senator Kukesh?
I want to follow up on Senator Meyer's question about notice. Is there any possibility at all to try to fix this bill that you consider some kind of notice, if feasible or if possible?
Sure.
Rather than just say no notice is required? Because I know a lot of military personnel, and a lot of them do get notice. You know, if they have to come from Afghanistan all the way back to the United States, that's a 2 or 3 day trip. Mm-hmm. So people would know. So if at all possible, the drafter should consider, and I'm not giving him orders or anything, I'm just suggesting it, that some kind of notice, if possible, should be given to an employer. I don't know. I think Senator Meyer has a good comment there about wanting to have employers get notice if there's at least the possibility of doing that. Sometimes if you get wounded and you're getting back to ship to the United States or getting shipped to Germany, maybe you don't have notice, but then those are circumstances that could be maybe even drafted into the circumstance of the bill.
I think that's an excellent suggestion, and we'd be happy to try to work on some language for that.
Okay. And I would, you know, suggest, too, why not like 24 hours or 48 hours?
24 hours is what I would
suggest. Surely the family has 24-hour notice before the soldier will return. So I'm going to go ahead on.
I think Senator Meyer still had a couple questions.
Did you have any more questions, Senator Meyer?
Well, I had a follow-up question. I mean, I was taking on your question about how to verify it, that indeed, if even if they give you notice of 48 hours, I'm going to take the next 10 days off. I'm paid to be with my spouse who was in Afghanistan. If there's some way for the employer then to know that indeed, her spouse is even in the military.
Sure.
There should be some way to check on that relatively easy. And not that we should have to do that, but unfortunately, like any good program, people will abuse it, and it's...
Absolutely. We can work on some language in that regard.
I like this bill as well, and I like that it really zeroes in on a combat zone, so it's not like we're going off in every direction with military, but... So I'm going to go ahead at this point and have Jeffrey Mittman from the ACLU. Jeffrey, are you online?
I am, Madam Chair.
Would you like to state your name, please, and affiliation for the record and offer testimony?
Certainly. My name is Jeffrey Mittman. I am the Executive Director of the ACLU of Alaska. And I want to thank the chair and the committee for considering this legislation, and thank Senator Wilikowski for introducing it. I'm particularly grateful as a former infantry lieutenant in the United States Army. I appreciate that the state of Alaska is particularly protective of our military families. We have submitted to the committee written testimony, which will expand upon the remarks I'll give. Essentially, the ACLU is concerned with constitutional rights and civil liberties under the U.S. and Alaska constitutions, and we review legislation proposed in the Alaska State Legislature on those grounds. With respect to this bill, in addition to supporting this thoughtful, compassionate leave for those Alaska families where one member is serving in the military and defending our freedoms, we would ask that the committee make a slight modification to the bill, and we hope that both the sponsor and the committee can support this. Under the Alaska Supreme Court's ruling in ACLU v. Alaska, the Supreme Court recognized that because the Alaska Constitution forbids same-sex domestic partners from the opportunity to legally marry, it is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause to confer differential benefits by the government on legally married spouses and deny them to same-sex domestic partners. So we would ask that the bill be amended, and where it states spouses, that it also include spouses or same-sex couples or same-sex domestic partners. The nonpartisan Urban Institute has estimated there are approximately 65,000 lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender individuals serving the United States military in both combat and non-combat zones. Many of these LGBT members also have families, and it is as important for these families to be able to spend time with their partners, their children, their family members, as for legally married spouses. Be a wonderful and affirming recognition by the legislature of the current realities of veterans and of combat members, and in keeping with the Supreme Court. Thank you.
Mr. Mittman, will the military personnel have a same-sex partner declared?
It was an interesting question, and the Chair, I believe this is based on the current policy of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Obviously, at this point, it would not be possible under federal law to require this for the military, but what the state is doing here is recognizing the rights of the non-military member. So, for example, state employee who's in a committed partnership with a member of the military would inform his or her employer that they would like leave so they could spend time with their family member. That does not require the family member's identity be disclosed to the military and is not in violation of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? No. Oh, Senator Kukesh.
It's an interesting scenario, but I'm going back to Senator Meyer's question of how do you prove that somebody's in a military when you're an Alaska spouse? How do you do that here? I don't know. I don't know the answer. I'm just bringing it up because it's an interesting scenario that the bill sponsor and the drafter are going to have to look at, I'm sure. But Senator Meyer asked a question, even for people who are married under the state of Alaska statutes, that we have to ask them to prove that they have a military spouse and a military connection. So this might be another hurdle that the sponsor and the bill drafter have to look at.
Through the Chair, Senator Kukesh, the issue of documentation has been handled in the ACLU v. State matter. Essentially, it's a two-part process. For any employer who wanted verification of domestic partnership, there are various matters that can be submitted, a notarized statement that there's a intertwined emotional and financial relationship, that there's been an ongoing relationship. And then the secondary proof would be documentation, for example, leave orders. So if a teacher wanted to, she could submit, for example, a statement to the school district, I am in a domestic partnership with, Sergeant Jones, and that would be on file with the school, which would, of course, already be required for provision of benefits. And if the school asked, leave orders could be provided where Sergeant Jones' name was on the leave orders, and it would provide the documentation that is required.
Any follow-up? Okay, thank you. Do you think that at all this would have a negative effect on small business to be hiring military spouses?
Madam Chair, again, I can have my staff speak to this. He spoke with several people in other states, and what we're told is that this has not, in other states, has had a detrimental impact. But let me have my staffer talk about that.
Thank you, George Ascott here. We may need to do more diligence on making sure our bill has safeguards for this sort of thing, but I did speak personally with Representative Sal Esquivel of Medford, Oregon, who championed this law, and he just said that nobody came against it, nobody said they would have any problem, they received no opposition, and since the bill passed, they've had no complaints. I also spoke with Sherry Pemberton, who is an assistant to Assemblymember Ted Liu, who also co-sponsored this legislation. She heard no complaints and has had none since the legislation has passed. And I also spoke with Donald Wilson, who is works for the California State Veterans Committee, and they told me that they had gotten no complaints, no opposition. The bill's mostly passed unanimously, and there haven't been any complaints to them anyway, but I would certainly be willing to look further into that.
And you shared with us that the first time this was enacted was 2007, is that correct?
That's my understanding, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator
Kukesh. Just to comment on it, when I read the NF IB letter, I was a little bit concerned about the small business disruption, but I really think if you have 19 employees and you're under 20, you're no longer a small business. And that's a huge number of people, 19 people, and I don't think taking one away from that is a disruption. Maybe if you lose five, you have a disruption, but I'm pretty comfortable with having the number set at 20, and I feel good, at least in that area. I'm comfortable with that.
Okay. Is there any other questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
This is Dan Wayne. I just wanted to offer something on the subject of an employee proving their status as being a spouse of a person who's in combat and so forth. And just a review that I've done here in the last 10 minutes, all of our leave statutes for state employees, looks like they pretty much leave it up to the departments to regulate that. And, the burden is always on the employee. The burden is always on the employee to provide information if they're asked for it by their employer. Just like any employee that takes leave anywhere, you tell your boss that you're sick, and if they don't believe you, then they can ask you to bring a note from a doctor or something like that. I mean, I think that's kind of implied in all of these. For example, I've looked at the leave for organ or bone marrow donations, 3920-275. It tells what you have to do to be eligible for that leave, but it doesn't require the presentation of any evidence in support of it. That's all I had, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. We have one other person, and I was going to ask if anyone from the Department of Military Affairs is here. I don't see any, but we'll go ahead with Stacy Bannerman.
Hello,
Stacy.
Hello, Madam Chair.
Would you state your name?
Stacy Bannerman.
Thank you, and your affiliation.
I am a Blue Star wife of an Army National Guard soldier who returned from his second combat deployment in Iraq in the fall of 2009, and in all likelihood will be serving a third deployment. And I'm very grateful to you and the Senate State Affairs Committee for considering this extremely important bill, Senate Bill 278. In a few short months, another 30,000 troops will be deploying to Afghanistan again. The majority of those troops are married with children, and most of the spouses left behind work outside the home. Many of us have to choose between work and family when our loved one deploys. It's an impossible choice, and one that military families should never be asked to make when America is at war. Now, changes to the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act do allow military families to take time off for a number of reasons connected with a deployment, but that law protects only a very few military family members. Most of us who work for smaller companies, work part-time, are seasonal or contract labor, or because of a recent PCS, have less than 1 year on the job, just aren't eligible under current law. Senate Bill 278 would offer the protection that our families need so that we are able to spend much-needed times with our loved ones immediately prior to, during, and or after deployment without fear of losing our jobs or being forced to choose between work and family. In order to verify this, family members can certainly provide a document, provide a copy of their orders of their loved one to their employer when they're spouse is on Title 10 status, and any additional questions or concerns above and beyond a copy of those orders certainly could be addressed to the Family Readiness Coordinator. My husband is a Sergeant First Class with the Army National Guard. This last deployment, they spent several months training more than 1,000 miles away from home and family prior to shipping out for a second tour in Iraq. I had recently accepted a new position to implement programs to help military families and veterans. I'd only been on the job a few months. I had no sick leave or vacation time available. It would be more than 1 year before I saw my husband again. If we support the troops and, by extension, military families, and this is the first time in the history of this nation that the burdens of war have been borne virtually exclusively by our troops and families during an extended, ongoing conflict, then it's critical that we implement programs to support our families and pass Senate Bill 278. Because when the soldier goes to war, so does the family. And when the veteran comes home, family support is the single most critical factor in successful reintegration of that veteran. The demands of the war on terror and the demographics of the 21st century military are very different from the past. And adapting to those realities must, by definition, include expanding support for military families. Here's a comment from a military wife about why we need a Military Family Leave Act now. She wrote, "I have heard too many times now of women who have had no cooperation from their employers for time off before their husbands have deployed, or no time off when their husbands come home for R&R or are home for good. Women have had to make the choice sometimes of quitting their jobs in order to have that time with their husbands. And in today's economy, that is clearly not the best choice for some families." Another military spouse wrote, "I think it's a great idea. I've had friends treated poorly over asking for time off when their hubbies were coming home from 15-month deployments, and friends who subsequently had to quit their jobs in order to get that time that is so well-deserved and much needed. I just can't believe any normal person wouldn't understand the importance of this time." I've got one more. Another military wife, and this is Mandy from Portland, Oregon, said, "I just want to say yes, it is about time we need a Military Family Leave Act. My husband left in October last year on his second tour to Iraq. I have had to travel cross-country to see him for 4 days at Fort Dix, New Jersey, and I almost lost my job because of it. I had to fight for it after calling upper management and the mayor's office. They finally backed off. There's still a lot of tension at work. He'll be home this summer for his 2 weeks, and I'm already fighting for time off as we speak. They always ensure that they support the troops and my husband, but they're sorry I can't have the time off. I hope the bill passes so I don't have to worry about spending time with my husband and our children in the future." And so 10 days, that's what we're talking about here. For the businesses that would be affected, it's a tiny, tiny sacrifice to help shoulder the burden of war borne exclusively by our troops and their families for nearly 9 years. But for the military family members that would be affected, those 10 days would be a great gift. And for some of us, the reality is that our soldier will come home in a box. In the very worst case scenario, we would spend the rest of our lives wishing for those last 10 days of time with our beloved. 10 days. Surely Alaska's military families deserve that.
Thank you, Stacy, for that passionate testimony, and we certainly appreciate you sharing those two letters with us as well. Do any committee members have a comment or question of Stacy?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Meyer.
Stacy, thank you for your testimony. That was it's very thoughtful, and it gave us a lot of insight that maybe we hadn't had before. The only question I have is that when your husband comes home, do you get notice that he's coming home, or and if so, how much notice? Because I think we all support the thought of time off. It's just, you know, time off without giving the employer, whether it be your school teacher, your nurse, you work at Fred Meyer, not giving your employer some notice.
Thank you, sir, and thank you also for your interest in supporting Senate Bill 278. Regarding the issue of an advance notice of leave, whether it be, you know, prior to the actual deployment or when they're coming home, generally speaking, yes, we do have advance notice. And I think, again, generally speaking, I think it's reasonable to ask for and to be able to receive, you know, up to 2 weeks advance notice. And, you know, from the family members to be given to their employer that here's the anticipated deployment date, here's the anticipated redeployment date, those kinds of things we usually, you know, start to get a heads up on 2 to 4 weeks in advance. So that's it. That I think is absolutely reasonable and absolutely doable. Of course, there are sometimes, you know, last minute changes that move things up or down, you know, 48 hours or so. But generally speaking, that kind of, you know, advance notice, I think, should not represent any kind of a significant challenge. And typically when there is, mid-deployment leave, when they're coming home for two-week R&R, there is also some level of advance notice, of a couple of weeks. But again, that also is subject to change. And so I think, you know, with employers, first of all, getting a copy of the soldiers' orders, Title 10 orders for deployment, you know, from that military family member employee prior to the soldier's deployment, I think that would be a really great tool. And then also, you know, military family members need to be communicating with their employers and letting them know these dates in advance. Obviously, as I think was remarked earlier, there are going to be some incidences, unfortunately, with casualties that obviously that kind of an advance notice is going to be impossible. But generally speaking, that notice can be provided.
Thank you, Stacy. I do see Nikki Neal is in the back, and would you like to come forward, please, and from your perspective from the Department of Personnel, and state your name for the record, please, and affiliation.
For the record, Madam Chair, I'm Nikki Neal, the Director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations within the Department of Administration. Okay. And I understand, I did hear Senator Meyer ask a question, if I could address
that. Yes, please.
Senator Meyer, you had expressed some concern about the 10-day period of leave with no notice and the ability to backfill and that there wasn't a fiscal note and wouldn't there be a cost associated with that. And, you know, realistically, we do have employees who have unexpected periods of leave. Most commonly, when it's 10 days or less, we don't actually backfill because there's just not time to plan and get somebody in there and sometimes train them to perform the work. So most commonly what occurs is other employees take on some of that work, the supervisor takes on some of that work, and then at times there is some work that can be delayed for a few days. It's when there's an immediate need to complete something that will assign the work to others. We also have the ability to place an employee in acting status. There is a small cost associated with that. It does increase their pay slightly, but we typically absorb that cost when we have an absence.
Okay, any other questions? Follow-up?
Yeah, if I may. Now, I know, like, school teachers aren't state employees, so that wouldn't be our fiscal note. It'd be the school districts. But, like, the university professors, if they're mm-hmm. if they're gone for 10 days, don't you have to bring in substitute teachers for the class?
We do not have oversight over the university. So the Division of Personnel does not support them. They have their own HR office, so I would assume so, but I don't know how they handle matters.
Okay. If I can follow up.
Yes, Senator Meyer.
Don't we have some state employees that are teachers, though, like at Mount Edgecombe or somewhere?
Yes, through the chair. We do have teachers at Mount Edgecombe.
Okay.
And we do have a pool of substitutes that they pull from. We also have teachers at AvTech, instructors, the Vocational Technical Institute. And so there is a cost with that, but they pull substitutes for other reasons. I don't know, and you know, cover that cost within their budget. I don't have any way of knowing how many military spouses we actually have working, so it's hard to know if, for example, Mount Edgecombe High School, which has a pretty small staff, how what an impact that would have on them.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not going to talk about the fiscal note. We're not the finance department, but it just seems like it should be an indeterminate fiscal note because you don't know what the impact would be to Mount Edgecombe or AvTech if you had an employee gone for 10 days and you had to backfill with your substitutes, because I'm sure you have to pay your substitute something.
Through the chair, absolutely we do. And at this point in time when we have absences, they just manage it within their budget as far as paying them.
Okay, thank you.
Can I just have a simple question? Do you think the 10 days is a reasonable amount of days that, given the expertise that you have running personnel for the department, that that's acceptable and manageable?
Yeah, Senator Menard, I do think 10 days is reasonable. You know, realistically, we do have employees who will have a death in the family, who will have a family member with an unplanned, or themselves with an unplanned medical issue that we can't always plan for. I wouldn't expect this within any one unit to occur too regularly. Mm-hmm. So it's my belief that it could be managed.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any other questions of Ms. Neal? Okay, thank you, Nikki, very
thank
much.
You.
Is there anyone else that wants to testify at this time? Okay, I'm going to close public testimony.
I think you had
to. Oh, I'm sorry.
He's on the list.
I will ungavel that.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Denny DeWitt. I'm the Alaska State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. We do have concerns with the bill for a number of reasons. I provided a letter to the committee. Many of the issues have been raised by the committee, which are very difficult for small employers to deal with. The issue of notice is particularly of concern. In terms of the exemption for employers under 20, we have a number of small employers who, particularly in, for example, the tourism season, who will go over 20 at a time when they basically need all of their employees on a pretty much a crash basis. So when we talk about small employers and someone over 20 not being a small employer, I think that's not accurate in terms of how most small employers in Alaska actually operate. If you're in an area near a military base, let's take North Pole for example, you might have half to three quarters of your employees spouses of the military. Under our reading of this bill, we just had 4,000 folks rotate home in Fairbanks. If you have 4,000 spouses taking unnoticed leave, it certainly can be devastating, and probably you're going to hit more than one or two employees in a number of small employers. So it becomes a logistical problem for small employers. The employers I've talked to since this bill was introduced, for the most part, as with a number of other kinds of things that employers need, try and work things out with their employees, sorting out how they can keep the business running and provide opportunities for time off on some sort of a basis. But to the extent that you shut down a business, you also close off a number of other opportunities for employment in the community. For a small employer, ordinarily you're looking at overtime for filling those vacancies, and that's a significant cost. Even if you're in a position where you're able to backfill at maybe a somewhat lesser cost, which in a lot of small employees for a lot of small employers is a great difficulty, you're still carrying the cost of benefits under the criteria of this bill. We would also suggest that there are a lot of penalty sections in this bill which we're not sure are particularly necessary. Particularly, we would call your attention to the section of law relative to jury duty, where in one statute you're requiring someone be away from work and you're requiring that the employer provide time off. We think the penalties are substantially less, for example, for jury duty than they would be for this bill. So we think that those sections need to be seriously looked at. In terms of expanding...
Sorry, excuse me, if I can... You would like it to mirror what we do for jury duty? Is that what...
Well, we think that that certainly would be more appropriate than what we find in the bill that's written here. And again, it's based on the notion that in that section, the state, or in that instance, the state has a vested interest in protecting the job of the employee because by law, the employee is required to be somewhere else.
Okay.
This is a different situation. As a final note, we would suggest that the legislature is the board of directors for state government. And if there's a problem, and oftentimes there is, with state employment being as flexible as the private sector, then we think that you should move ahead. If you think that the state needs to have this sort of specific authorization or requirement in law, but to apply it to the private sector, we think is inappropriate activity and interference from government into the private sector.
Okay. Senator Kukesh.
A couple of comments, especially on your last one. In order to do business in the state, you have to buy a state business license. So I think we have every right to do what we're considering today. I have a couple of questions because I've always been in a mind in my lifetime that if I see a problem, I suggest some solutions, because we all agree here that we have a goal here that we're trying to meet, and that is to, when people come home from military leave, that we can get a spouse to meet with them, especially if they're only here for a short period of time and have to go back into the combat zone. So I would like to have you spend some time on looking at this bill and see what we have to change to make it work for the end result, which is getting spouses together when there's a short period of time when they can be. My second point to your comment about when you have 4,000 people coming back to Fairbanks to come home, they're coming home. They're not on leave. They're not on short military leave where they're coming out of combat zone and going right back, and I think we have to address that as a concern. So I wonder if at least those two comments I can get some reply to.
Through the chair, Senator Kukesh, I can reflect on my experience when my son has come home from both Iraq and Afghanistan. He comes home on leave when he's rotating back home. Many of the folks who come back, those folks who just came back, come back and are on leave. As we read this bill, that would be covered by this bill. So we think that that's a consideration and an issue that needs to be considered in this bill. We don't read this bill to say it's only if you're on R&R, for example. We read it as if you were deployed, you come home from deployment, or you come back from deployment on leave, that this bill affects you. So I guess we might have a difference of understanding on how this bill is written.
And we do, but I really would like to hear your answer on how do we get to the end result we're trying to get to, and how can you help us get there?
Through the chair, Senator Kukesh, I've talked to a number of our members who live and have businesses, particularly near our bases, which is where the issue is the most critical. I have not had one of them tell me that they've had a problem that they haven't been able to work through. And they don't see that there's a need for state legislation to get into the middle of trying to deal with their employees, which they do as best they can. So from our perspective, we're not seeing it as a particular problem that's come to the attention of folks that I've been able to talk to. One of the things that we do find is oftentimes governmental employees, because of the structure of statutes, have more difficulty accommodating employees on different issues than the private sector does. And the private sector, most of our employees and employers know each other. I mean, they're not strangers to each other, and they work through these problems, particularly if there's an emergency or if there's a particular need that's articulated. The problem that we have is when you bring the heavy hand of government in, it makes it more difficult for the private sector to deal with issues than they do on their own.
I need a follow-up.
Yes, a follow-up.
I still would like to hear a quick answer of, no matter what we do to this bill, you still are not going to support it, I suppose. So I want to just ask you the question about the young lady who testified earlier. I mean, that's a problem. That's kind of a problem we're trying to address here.
Through the chair, and I don't know who the employers were, but in part of her testimony, she indicated that I heard that one was from Portland, and I can't speak for what they do in Oregon. We have in this state a very different relationship with the military than most states. If you talk to most of the folks who rotate through here in the military, you'll find that they will tell you that Alaska employers, the state, everybody here has a different view of the military than they find in most states. And I think that's true of small employers. Secondly, there was reference to having to go up the chain to the mayor, which again tells me it's a public employer that they've had problems with as opposed to a private employer. Now, that's not to say that there are probably not one or two examples in the entire field relative to private employers, but I think that if you look at the private employers in Alaska, they have been very supportive. They want to continue the ability to hire military spouses, but the more difficult it becomes, the more difficult it is for employers to maintain their business and the jobs that they offer, and that's our concern. It's not that, you know.
Thank you. Thank you, and I think that's our concern too. And I appreciate that there's been a lot of good minds here and good discussion. And as we said, it's pretty new to this whole topic. And there is federal, if we understand it correctly, there's going to be federal legislation coming out on this topic as well. Okay, Senator Meyer.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually. It would be interesting to see how that federal law is progressing, simply because I think it is unfair for a soldier to be in one state that maybe doesn't have this policy, but another state does. Because if I was a soldier getting ready to go to Iraq or something, I'd say, you know, I want to be stationed in Alaska because they have a better package for my spouse when I come home than say, I don't know, Idaho. I think one conclusion we've come to here, and I think you would agree, is that at the least we should do in this bill is to give notice, if at all possible. And as the bill is written now, that they don't have to give any notice whatsoever. So small business, and how do you define a small business? Is that anything under 100 employees? Or?
Through the chair, there are a number of different levels. Typically, the federal notion is under 100, but as one of your colleagues noted the other day, who runs a hospitality operation, he has 225 employees, but he's working against major global employers. So he has different issues than a large store. Don Abel's out here will have 50 to 75 employees as opposed to the number that Home Depot and Fred Meyers have. But you have to remember that part of what differentiates, if you will, large and small employers are their multi-state nature, the fact that they can get access to ERISA programs as opposed to insurance programs. There are a whole lot of things that I think describe a small employer beyond just the number of employees. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Do the committee members have any comments or questions at this time? Then I feel it's in the best interest of the committee to hold Senate Bill 278 for a future hearing, and if we can get some of these questions maybe fine-tuned, and I'd try to schedule it for next week at maybe next, we'll be gone at energy, but in the nearest future that I can make that happen. And I'd like to thank everybody for their testimony, and we now are adjourned.